Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. And in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with John Pfeffer. He is an independent journalist. He's written on a number of subjects, on globalization and militarization in different ways. He's written about Korea and about what has been going on in Korea in recent years, and also about the relationship between Korea and the United States and between Russia and the United States. And broadly speaking, he's interested in globalization. And that's really what we'll be talking about here in this first part of the show, and certainly on past programs. We've talked a lot in different ways about globalization. This time, I think the focus will be a little bit different because we'll be talking about food and how the ways that we eat, how food is produced, how we think about it, bears certainly an important relationship to some of the other issues that we talk about when we talk about globalization. He is here to give a talk as part of a series on globalization that's sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus, also the ACES Global Connect series and the Korea workshop. So a lot of different units on the campus are responsible for his being here. He's going to give a talk dealing with some of the things we'll be talking about here this morning. Giving a talk on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. That's on the U of I campus. It's on Illinois Street. And these programs, like all of the MillerCom events, often we have speakers from that series. They're always free and open to the public, so anybody who was interested in stopping by and hearing what he has to say this afternoon should feel welcome. And, of course, on this particular program here, you can also call in and ask questions, make comments. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, for folks who would like to call in, the number is 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
As I said on this program before, many times with different guests, we've talked about globalization, different sorts of ways. But I am interested in what you have to say, and because it's very different. It's a different take. A lot of the same issues, I'm sure, but it's a different way of thinking about it, and maybe it's a way that people can identify with a little bit more closely, at least in the sense that it has to do with something that we all do, and that's eat. How does eating and not just that, but what we eat, and now how we think about, particularly, you know, people here in the United States that are fortunate, that have the means, that have access to a wide range of food, how does that give us a way of thinking about and talking about globalization?
Well, you point out a very important point, and that is that you know, when I raise the issue of globalization with my friends or colleagues, sometimes their eyes glaze over, you know. But if I raise the issue of food, suddenly people get very excited. They want to talk about their favorite restaurants or their recipes or even some of the underlying trends around food. And I discovered, in a very simple way that the writing I had done on foreign policy was of less interest to people often than writing about food. In a very, very vivid way, I went to my dentist, and he had all this stuff in my mouth, you know, and he asked me what I was writing about, which he often does. And I said, well, you know, I'm doing something on Korean foreign policy with the United States. He's like, yeah, what else? I'm doing something on regional security issues in Asia. He said, well, what else? You know, I've got all this stuff in my mouth. And I said, well, I'm doing something on food. And he got so excited, he took all of the stuff out of my mouth. And he said, oh, now that is what I'm interested in. Tell me about food. What are you writing about food? So I think food, obviously, is something we all eat. And it's a way into a subject, in this case, globalization, that I think makes it much more concrete for people, much more understandable. Let me give you another example of sure. of how, say, food reflects global issues. I recently came across an interesting example of a bento box. A bento box is a Japanese meal. It's very popular in Japan, especially you go to a train station and you can order them for your train journey. It's kind of an easy takeout meal. Today, like yesterday or tomorrow, about 10,000 organic bento boxes are on sale in Tokyo Station and in stations around Tokyo in Japan. And they're maybe a little bit more expensive than your non-organic bento box. But it's become a very popular item. Every element in that bento box was produced about 20 miles outside of San Francisco. Not in Japan, but in San Francisco. The elements of that bento box, the rice came from California, the pork came from Mexico, the salmon came from Alaska, the eel came from China, all the way back to San Francisco, put into the bento box, sent over to Japan. The reason it's made in San Francisco rather than in Japan is because of the cost of labor, the cost of the ingredients, and it turns out that the actual cost of shipping it back to Japan is negligible. And this is a reflection of the global trade in food that we now experience. When we go to a restaurant, when we go to the supermarket, when we go to a food court, 100 years ago, our food was largely locally grown. Sometimes it was grown a city over. But more and more, our food is grown in a global marketplace and distributed globally. We're often not aware of these trends. And yet, if we just investigate a little bit, we uncover an enormous range of global issues behind the most ordinary things that we eat.
Yeah. Well, that's a fascinating example. I guess the thing that right away I think about is the Japanese sense that what's Japanese is the best. And it would sort of surprise me, and perhaps they don't really think about that, that, for example, that in Japan, I suppose in all of Asia, rice is extremely important. And that as far as the Japanese are concerned, the best rice in the world is Japanese rice. And if you take, I'm thinking if you take most Japanese, in fact, and if you make up some rice and you just put the bowls down in front of people and you say, taste this and tell me where that rice is from, I would expect that a lot of Japanese could pick which one had been grown in Japan and which one had been grown someplace else. And I would certainly expect that they would say, and of course, the Japanese rice is best.
Well, you put your finger on the key distinction, and that is what the French call terroir, or sense of place. And it's something that we're familiar with in France with vintages for wine. You know, people in France, if they drink a glass of wine, they can often say, well, I know exactly the vineyard. I know what side of the street, of the road, that the grapes came from. And it extends beyond wine as well to meats. You know, there's sheep that are graze in the northern part along the seashore. And that flavors the lamb, and people prize that in France a great deal. The same is true in Japan. And it's absolutely correct that Japanese will say, well, the rice of Ibaraki Prefecture, or even this particular farm. And interestingly, as people move away from the countryside, and there's been a tremendous move away from the countryside to the cities in Japan, there's been a corresponding evaluation or higher valuation of the products of the countryside. For instance, in Japan, you can become a member of a society from a small town that you never actually grew up in, that your parents never came from, but you get honorary membership in this small town, and every month they send you a box with the products from that small town. And that is your connection to terroir, to the sense of place that is in some sense mythic, because of course you never came from that place, but you can acquire it. When it comes to these bento boxes, in some sense, the bento boxes are that I was talking about before, the organic bento boxes are a departure from that sense of place because these ingredients come from all over the world. And the rice, horror of horrors, comes from California. Mm-hmm. And the key issue with these bento boxes is that there are still major tariffs that prevent California rice from coming into Japan. But the manufacturers of these bento boxes came upon an interesting twist in the rules that said, this is import rules in Japan, that if something had at least 20% protein as part of it as a package, then it didn't matter if the rice came along with it. And so they could kind of get these bento boxes under the radar of the tariff scheme and sell them for a reasonable price. So it's kind of revolutionary for Japan and for Japanese to actually depart from the conventional pricing of local rice and to start buying organic, but organic that's not local, organic that is actually a global product.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Pfeffer. He's an independent journalist and author. He has written a number of things. He's written about, for example, Korea and the relationship between the U.S. and Korea. He's the author of North Korea, South Korea, a U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis, published by Seven Stories in 2003. He's also written about militarism and globalism. He's the editor of the book Living in Hope, People Challenging Globalization, published by Zed Books, 2002. He's former associate editor of World Policy Journal. He's also worked for American Friends Service Committee, most recently as an international affairs representative in East Asia. And he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He's going to give a talk dealing with some of the things he's been talking about here this morning. This is as part of the Globalization series, sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study. His visit also is co-sponsored by the ACES Global Connect series and also the Korea workshop on the U of I campus. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, he'll be talking this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And if you're interested in stopping by, you can do that. Also here on the call on the show, if you want to call in, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly food and attitudes toward food are connected with people's culture. Change can change greatly from one place to the next. So the old joke is sort of depends on how you've been raised, what you think is food, and there are probably people who eat just about somewhere in the world, just about eat whatever there is to eat. So it's a way that individual groups are really distinctive. At the same time, I'm sure that in very many ways that globalization tends to kind of blend things and also wash out differences. I mean, here, you know, for example, you're going to be making some reference to how you can the experience of now, if you go, I'm sure, to any mall in the United States and go to the food court and see what sort of things are offered, you will see foods that are inspired by, maybe reflect some of the tastes of a lot of other places around the world, adjusted also, I'm sure, for an American palate and what Americans want. But still, you know, there are flavors and the ways of cooking things that are not native to America, that come from other places. So that, I guess I'm interested in that issue of, yes, it's true that now that people, different places are exposed to the foods and other things of other places, and yet somehow it's all getting mushed up together so that I wonder at the same time whether the individual identities of places and their cultures are also getting kind of washed out, mm-hmm. because of stuff coming from elsewhere, maybe even their own elements of their own culture being reinterpreted back to them, mm-hmm. by somebody else.
Yes. Well, there's a Japanese theorist who uses the expression cultural odor of exports. And he was referring to Japanese anime, Japanese cartoons. Mm-hmm. So if you see Japanese cartoons, you notice that the faces of the cartoon figures are not actually classically Asian or Japanese. Their eyes are large and round, for instance. And that is done deliberately to make them exportable, to make them palatable to a certain extent in other cultures. So he says, you know, that the cultural odor is eliminated in some of these products. And you can see the same thing with food. For instance, instant ramen. I mean, college students, you know, live on instant ramen, you know. It's one of the cheapest things around. Does it bear any relationship to real ramen soup that you can get in Japan? Not really. I mean, the stuff is, well, barely palatable, you know, this instant stuff. It was introduced in the 1950s. the instant ramen version. If you go to Yokohama today, you can go to the Ramen Museum, which is a kind of a paean to the process of making ramen into a global product, an incredibly popular Japanese export. But it's also a place that you can find authentic ramen because it has a food court there, which is unlike a food court you would find here in the United States, because all you can get is ramen. I mean, you go to a food court here in Champaign-Urbana and you expect variety, you know, a little bit of Chinese food, a little bit of Italian food, some pizza, whatever. You don't expect to go to a food court and have seven different types of hot dogs vendors, you know? But that's what the food court is in Yokohama at the Ramen Museum. You have approximately 8 or 10 different ramen varieties from around the country. And it's an opportunity for people who live in the Tokyo area, which is where Yokohama is, to sample Sapporo-type ramen, for instance. So you go to that food court and you say immediately, as an American, you say, oh my God, there's no diversity. It's just ramen noodles. But then you realize, oh, actually, there's incredible diversity here. And the diversity, again, reflects what we were talking about before, and that is the sense of place. That the ramen that is served in Sapporo is actually fundamentally different than the ramen that you would get in Kyushu. Japan's not a very big country, and yet, because of differences in climate, differences in culture and soil, what have you, it produces different kinds of food. So it's a wonderful place to kind of see the differences of ramen within the country, but also the tremendous difference between what is, to a certain extent, authentic, and we can talk about authenticity and what is authentic, but for the time being, authentic ramen noodle soup and this pale variety for export that has come to represent ramen soup here in the United States for so many people. Mm.
Well, we have someone to talk with, and we'll bring them into the conversation right now. Let's do that. This is someone listening in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I hope this question makes some kind of sense. Once it came to my mind, I started thinking, well, it may not make any sense at all, but here it goes. In terms of globalization, and let's assume that this is down the road a lot, there's huge food conglomerates controlling the market. Will the market pressures be such that if you make the best eels or the cheapest eels, that's where eels are going to come from? And if you do wheat, that's where the wheat's going to come from. So that in a sense, certain areas or countries are going to be forced to only produce certain foods so that they'll fit into the conglomerate's view of how things should be done in terms of making profits. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
It's a very good question. I would change only one thing, and that it's really not down the road. I mean, we see that process take place today, not so much in the powerful agricultural countries, United States, Canada, Australia, but certainly in the smaller agricultural countries in Africa and so forth, countries that don't have the power to stand up to the large conglomerates. So, for instance, in a small African country, which has been depending on, say, okra or cassava for local consumption, that food is not really exportable to Europe. I mean, there's not a big demand for cassava in France or in Germany, certainly not big enough to support an export economy in Togo, for instance. So instead, what has happened is that there has been market forces have determined what people in Togo or in Zambia are growing. And what are they growing? They're growing what the supermarkets in Europe want, and that is these kind of smaller vegetables, boutique vegetables, snow peas. They're growing radicchio. I mean, whatever is popular in Europe, and obviously whatever the soil can support in these countries, but it's not being consumed locally. I mean, it's not like people are having stir-fried snow peas in Togo or Zambia. And so the market is largely determining that. Another case would be where large yields and monocultures are reshaping local agricultures. say, massive soybean production in Brazil or Argentina, or huge production of cabbage in China for export, or you see it in the flour market. Just the land that had previously been devoted to local agriculture, to feeding, you know, people locally, has been given over to orchid production or to tulip production or rose production for the flower shops in the United States and Europe. And so you see this today. It's really not something that that we have to wait 10 or 15 years to identify as a trend.
Well, that's what's striking there is it seems that things then, even though we like to think that we're past the period of past the colonial period, that respect where the larger nations are using the smaller ones to produce one or two things or taking advantage of whatever their natural resources are, and that then those nations have to devote large sections of their economy to producing something for export, that really hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed. I mean, it's something I'll be talking about this afternoon. I'll be comparing the kind of dependency that Ireland was under with British rule in the 19th century, the dependency that they were on export to the British market, and then dependency, of course, on potatoes, which proved to be so fatal, so tragic in 1846 and 1847 during the Great Potato Famine. Now, the difference, of course, one could argue or has been argued is that in the past, the colonial powers would dictate what the smaller colonialized or colonized people would have to produce. And today people will say, oh, well, that's completely different because it's market forces. Market forces determine what is profitable and so forth. But I would say, first of all, you could go back to the 19th century or early 20th century and discover actually the colonizers used market forces more than we give them credit for today to kind of be the mechanism for determining what is grown. So for instance, Japan, when it colonized Korea and Taiwan, it didn't simply say, well, you have to grow millet for the consumption of Japanese troops, so you have to grow. No, they essentially relied largely on market forces to determine what Korean farmers and Taiwanese farmers were doing. But the result was the same, and that was it was largely extraction of what was produced, extraction of agricultural products, and then no capacity for or limited capacity for manufacturing. So it was kept in a kind of agrarian dependency. And then the Japan or Britain or whatever the colonial powers were in the 19th century would then export their finished products, their manufactured products to the captive markets in their colonies. Well, that looks rather similar to what we have today with the large industrial manufacturing powers doing the same, although we have a couple of transitional countries like China, for instance, which has turned itself into a large manufacturing site. But you still have large sections of the world, Africa, sections of Latin America and Asia, which don't have that kind of manufacturing capacity and are in a sort of feudal arrangement with respect to their agricultural production and the markets of the industrialized world. Hmm.
We are at our midpoint here in this first hour of Focus 580, talking with journalist and author John Pfeffer. He has written on a number of subjects, globalization in many different respects. He's written about Korea. He's the author of the book North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis, published in 2003. He's a former associate editor of World Policy Journal. He's also worked for the American Friends Service Committee, most recently as an international affairs representative in East Asia. He's here visiting the campus. Going to give a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on dealing with some of these same issues that we're talking about here, about globalization and how by looking at food, you can see an illustration of some of the issues that we have been talking about now for some time with globalization. He also, I believe, is working on a book that deals with this very subject. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here in the United States, I know other places in Europe as well, I think that there is a small but perhaps growing movement of people who are really interested in food and who are very interested in supporting their local producers and the local product. I'm going back thinking about your example of the bento box in Japan. As you said, if you go to a train station, you can buy essentially a boxed meal. Sometimes they're very elaborate. It's the kind of thing if you're having some sort of a event, you can get them catered. Someone will drive up with the truck just loaded with these things and for all the attendees. And you were talking about the fact that there in Japan, the one that you came across, everything in there came from outside of Japan, including the rice. And I'm wondering, to what extent in Japan or perhaps elsewhere you see this same movement that I've talked about, this kind of movement among people who are very interested in encouraging and supporting local producers to, produce whatever. We could talk about vegetables. We could talk about cheese. We could talk about wine. We could talk about, whatever the product is, who are really interested in knowing the person who produces their food, being able, if they wanted to go there and see it, to know where it comes from, because they like the attitude of that person who is producing it, whatever that attitude is, and it's something that certainly we've seen here in the United States and in Europe as well. How are you seeing that, a lot of that, in other places as well?
Definitely. You're referring to the slow food movement, which began in Italy and has spread around the world as a reaction to McDonald's and fast food in general, but not just fast food, but a kind of attitude about food, which is not taking it seriously, not looking into it, not paying attention to its origins, not caring about taste. So you see this slow food movement in various forms. I think here in the United States and as well in Europe and other countries, part of it is an assertion of culture, saying this is our culture, whether it's a national culture, a regional culture, a local culture, or the culture of the tiny little, village. Part of it is a assertion of taste, saying taste is important. Food is not just about fuel. Food is about appreciation. It's about enjoyment. Part of it is fear. There's been, an explosion of genetically modified organisms around the world, and a feeling among a lot of people that there is no regulatory system that effectively maintains a safe food supply. And that's the case internationally, but that's also the case nationally in a lot of countries. It's certainly in the United States a great fear of GM. Europe, of course, has taken a different stance on GM and has tried to establish a region-wide, a Europe-wide set of regulations to ensure that the food supply is safer from GM contamination. So I think all of these elements are pushing this trend towards knowing who is growing your food, knowing who is preparing your food, and we see it in local cheese, artisan bread, and so forth. A lot of it is unfortunately on the high end of things. I mean, you have to spend a lot of money, but in some cases, you find that if you subtract out the travel costs, you actually can spend a reasonable amount of money. But the bottom line is that people who support this kind of movement say cheap food ultimately is not cheap. It's not cheap because, first of all, a lot of factors don't go into the price of food, like transportation, environmental hazard or despoilation. And it's not cheap in terms of the effects it has on us. We've gotten an enormous number of studies now at this point linking the kind of fast food diet to obesity and a range of health problems, the fact that we consume an enormous amount of corn syrup through sodas, that we are eating high-fat diets, that we're not eating any vegetables. You go to a food court, it's really hard to find a fresh fruit or a fresh vegetable or a fast food restaurant or even to a lot of sit-down chain restaurants. So cheap food fundamentally is not cheap. It has its costs largely hidden from us. So the people who support slow food say, well, actually, we would prefer to pay a little bit more money to know where the food comes from and to know that it's not going to have adverse effects on us. And that fundamentally, this kind of cheap food system that has been given to us, to pardon the expression, has been rammed down our throats, really had an adverse effect across the board. Soil erosion around the world, health problems around the world. And so the movement is starting at a local level and it's slowly coalescing. And it'll be interesting to see if it can kind of put forward an alternative, a kind of a quilt, so to speak, of local initiatives that can be a viable alternative to this mass global food system that we have now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other people who are listening. We have several. We'll start with a caller in Champaign County on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
The point you were talking about earlier about how much is so-called market forces, well, there's a lot between the quotes, it seems to me, you didn't mention the IMF or the World Bank. That's you know, coercion of a non-military, but it's backed up by the military. I'm thinking of the famous Tom Friedman quote about the hidden hand of McDonnell Douglas making the world okay for the commerce of McDonald's in the, I think he mentioned Silicon Valley, but you could fill in the blank. But, you know, I was calling the first to talk about the circle of poison, and we have this bizarre illustration of globalization and from the 60s, this guy in Britain who is surmising that the prions that cause mad cow may have come in shipments of bones that, you know, British were importing animal bones from India. It's a pretty just amazing, emblematic thing of the circle of poison. And you did point at, you know, there is no, when we import from so far away, we have no idea what the process and what, you know, we're doing pretty bad with pesticides here, but other places we're still selling stuff that we don't authorize for our use here. So it's important work, but it seems to me that there is a lot of coercion. I mean, it isn't like the gunboats that were extracting the debt service out of Haiti in the 30s, but some of that debt is probably still on the books, and we're using, you know, rather more high level. But to call that market forces that says a lot about what kind of market it is.
I would agree completely.
I'm going to hang up and listen because I have a lot of ambient noise.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
I agree with you completely. I wasn't arguing that it was market forces. I was saying it's often attributed to market forces. I too believe that what is often put forward as a set of supposedly neutral market forces are in fact conceal often very coercive measures. And to give you a couple of examples, the Green Revolution. Green Revolution was put together by U.S. foundations, U.S. research institutes, U.S. government, and it is kind of the centerpiece for taking an industrial model of agriculture and exporting it to the world. It relies on high-yield seed varieties, irrigation, high inputs of fertilizer, and high pesticide use. And, of course, it's highly reliant on oil or petroleum-based products. And that was pushed onto the Third World throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s in a largely coercive fashion. And it continues to be a kind of model for World Bank development programs in the agricultural sphere. The WTO, too, is often considered to be a neutral kind of place where market forces are allowed to butt up against one another. But in fact, the WTO, too, has played a coercive role in the sense that countries that try to maintain some kind of tariffs to preserve their domestic agriculture in the way that Japan keeps tariffs to preserve its rice production, Korea has tried to preserve beef production, countries throughout the world have tried to maintain some barriers through tariffs to keep small farmers farming. And through the WTO and the kind of worldwide reduction of tariff barriers, that has directly threatened the livelihoods of small farmers around the world. And that is directly coercive. I mean, it essentially pushes farmers out of their farms. We want to know why there's this consistent movement from the countryside into the cities around the world, why cities like Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Johannesburg, why these cities are growing at a rapid pace. It's because of disenfranchised farmers who can't make it any longer in the countryside because the tariff barriers have been eliminated and they can no longer compete against global products. So, and that is coercive. So this is, it's coercive not only from an international point of view, but also the key actors in the international agricultural sphere, the United States, primary among them, United States pushing for the reduction of barriers to trade while, of course, maintaining our own barriers in order to keep farmers here in the United States in business. So I, too, believe that it is as coercive as it was in the 19th century, though the mechanisms in some sense have changed a little bit, though, of course, as I said, the market was also a kind of coercive mechanism in the 19th century for colonial powers as well.
All right. We have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone here in Urbana, line one.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. I agree with you on this recolonization of the Third World through economic methods, but I'd say the recent globalization is really based on very inexpensive energy costs like oil, natural gas, which is actually changing probably in the next 10 or 15 years, so that's got to have some effect on it, like when you were stating the little box meals in Japan are actually made in San Francisco, and you said, well, basically the shipping costs are negligible because the energy costs and all the, the extant system that exists, but you were talking about the term market forces. It is really from Adam Smith, but it actually is more of, isn't that really more of a psychological term? I mean, because when you say market forces, people have a tendency to think of a natural force like, hydrogen fusion or something like that. And when in reality, economics is purely a human endeavor. So the forces behind economics is basically psychological. Mm-hmm. Whether you want to buy something, how much you will pay for something is purely determined by someone's either their psychological profile of it or the person involved in the purchase. But so I just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and sometimes this comes into the open, when American economists talk about the real estate market and they start mm-hmm. talking about irrational exuberance. Yeah. Like, now I understand. It is actually psychological.
It has to be. I've always – Dave, there's a guy on this program who comes on. He's an economist, and he's always using, market forces. And mm-hmm. I'm always thinking, it's just psychology. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys in the economics should be in the psychology department it's a science that doesn't exist outside of us, so right. It has to be a psychological thing.
Right.
I mean,
well,
I do marketing for people, mm-hmm. and it's basically all psychology. Mm-hmm.
Let me address your first question, because mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point as well.
Yeah.
Take the example of North Korea. North Korea had one of the most mechanized agricultures in all of Asia, more mechanized in some sense than South Korea or Japan.
Wow.
And in 1989, 1990, suddenly the price of energy skyrocketed for North Korea because the Soviet Union was no longer willing to give it at a subsidized rate. And China was also saying, hey, you have to pay hard currency. You have to pay cold cash for this energy. We're not just going to give it away any longer. And what happens? The entire farming system in North Korea collapsed.
Yes.
And I have often argued that the North Korean situation is not some kind of unusual situation. It's not something that is simply the result of mm-hmm. communist misplanning.
Well, incompetence, yeah.
Right. Although there was a lot of that. I know there is.
Well, there's incompetence in markets, too. I mean,
right. But in fact, the North Korean example is a cautionary example for all of us.
Yeah.
Because if the price of oil were to rise as precipitously in the United States mm-hmm. as it did in North Korea at that time, we would see agriculture go along the same trajectory in the United States.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned that because I've been looking for a model, and I never thought of it that way. But, once the communists recuse themselves from the other communists. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm just real leery of these oversimplifications of, well, you know, everything's, you know, you can fly something here for nothing. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no such thing as nothing.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your work.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's continue. We'll go here to another caller in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been interested in what, since you explained it now, a liquid version of the bento box in the United States, and that is with apple juice. At one time, one would buy a bottle of apple juice, and usually have some assurance was from the United States, even though we had problems here with our apples at one time or some controversy over it. But today, hidden on the bottle, if you look for it, it may say, may contain concentrate from Argentina, China, Hungary, Chile, and USA.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered about the different safety practices in the country, and is there any way when the apple juice is produced here to have some idea about how safe a product and what is the quality of that product?
That's a good question. It's, of course, not just apple juice. If you look at your orange juice as well, you'll see that the oranges might come from Florida, but they probably come from Brazil. The mechanism for determining the safety of products that are traded like that is the Codex, Codex Alimentarius. It was created in the early 1960s, currently based in Italy. And it is linked to the WTO. It's a set of regulations that cut across all commodities that are to be traded. And each major commodity grouping has a committee that comes up with and has come up over the last several decades, come up with a set of regulations that you have to meet if you're going to be participating in this kind of global trade of ingredients. That is for the good and for the bad. I mean, for the good, of course, the Codex mechanisms ensure that we don't have unsafe materials being traded around the world, or at least no more unsafe than what we have available in the United States. And that of course, is a controversial question. But in any case, it's more or less at that level of safety. For the worse, of course, is that the Codex, of course, is not an entirely neutral institution, as the WTO is not an entirely neutral institution. The playing field does kind of tilt in favor of the more powerful countries. So that, for instance, on the GM, genetically modified organism question, the United States has played hardball on this issue in the Codex deliberations, so that the kind of more strict standards that the Europeans are lobbying for and that they have some support from other countries around the world are being overwhelmed by the United States. So the United States would like the same kind of system that we have in the United States, where, frankly, we have no idea whether the material, whether, you know, what we're eating has GM corn in it or has GM soy in it. They want that to be the international model, and they're pushing for that in the Codex proceedings. So it's a mixed bag at the Codex level in terms of international safety and regulation.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Let's go to Chicago for another caller here. This is our line four, toll-free line.
Thank you.
Yes.
Along with the impact of natural weather forces upon the agricultural community, we have man's footprint suddenly devastating regions of the world that are further impacting our ability to grow things as it affects the weather, such as the deforestation of the rainforest and along the Amazon and other areas, the total pollution of water systems that are going to be used for irrigation, and other things such that our usual agricultural patterns of growing and raising food products are going to be totally changed, it seems, in the near future, and we're going to have to adjust to new regions and relationships for food survival. So I just thought I'd mention this ecological impact that we're having on food production. Thank you.
That's a very, very important point. And, I mean, we often have this kind of... and perhaps it's stronger here in the Midwest than it is, say, in the East Coast, where farms are not as close to the cities as they are here. But often a mythologized notion of agriculture as this kind of idealized, non-invasive, non-interventionary, idyllic kind of pursuit. And, of course, agriculture has always been a very aggressive form of dealing with the land, all the way back from at the beginning. And there have been some interesting studies on the relationship between hunting and gathering as a kind of more appropriate, you know, manner of dealing with the natural world than agriculture ever was. That agriculture from the very beginning in Mesopotamia and elsewhere in the world led to such dramatic transformations of ecology that the civilizations upon which these agriculture or that rested upon agricultural foundations, these civilizations collapsed. The Mayan civilization because of soil erosion, also war, but Mesopotamia, Sumerian culture because of soil erosion. Agriculture, in other words, has had dramatic ecological impact. And the kinds of impact we see today in the 20th century, 21st century, the Amazon rainforest, aquaculture, and the destruction of mangroves along the ocean. It's a continuation of this longer story. And I would recommend a book by Jason Clay. It's a very big volume, but it actually looks at the ecological impact of all major commodities. It goes through 26 major commodities, and it spells out in detail what those ecological impacts have been. And it's an incredible kind of guide to how to reconcile the ecological impulse of preservation and the agricultural impulse, which is how to feed a burgeoning population globally.
We're coming down the point here. We have maybe 3-4 minutes. When people talk about globalization and food, probably one of the most obvious kind of examples people point to is the proliferation of what we think of as American fast food companies in other countries. And McDonald's is probably going to be the one that gets the people's most attention, the thing that they think of first. But, of course, it's not McDonald's. I'm sure you go around the world, you go to major cities, you're going to see all of the same fast food vendors that we have in the United States. So it is not just McDonald's. And in some sense, maybe those companies are no longer American companies. Maybe they're multinational world companies, even though they might have started here in the United States. But I guess the thing I'm thinking about is, are there other food companies based in other countries who are doing the same kinds of things? And it's not just McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken. Maybe it's an English company. Maybe it's a French company. Maybe it's an Italian company or a Japanese company that are doing the same things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the Japanese Mos Burger, for instance, which has set up around Asia, basically the same as McDonald's in its approach. I mean, its products might be different. Of course, they have, for instance, a rice burger, you know, a burger that's in between two rice patties as opposed to wheat buns. But but its approach to how food is sourced, where it comes from, how it's produced and how it's sold, how people eat it, very similar to McDonald's. Your point about the origins of fast food, in some sense, McDonald's has made it an attempt to erase its American origins to such an extent that they've done interviews with little kids in China and other countries, and little kids think that McDonald's is a Chinese company. It's part of their culture, or it's Kenyan. culture that's no longer American. So it's no longer part of a kind of quote-unquote imperial, you know, imposition on the cultures of others. Rather, it's been totally integrated into the culture of these other countries. Coca-Cola is another perfect example. Coca-Cola is supposed to be identified as a global product, no longer attached to America, no longer attached to its origins as a medicinal drink that had cocaine in it. It has been stripped of all those associations so that it can be a product for everyone, regardless of where they come from and regardless of what they might think about America, especially in these anti-American days, mm-hmm. so that people could drink Coca-Cola even as they protest at the U.S. Embassy. Yeah. They see no contradiction in that.
Yeah. Well, I know maybe if I say something like this, some people will roll their eyes, but do you think that it is the case that today's multinational corporation is in fact the imperial power of today?
Well, you can definitely make profitable associations. for instance, an American corporation is multicultural. Their heads often are not from the countries that the corporation began in the same way that the Roman Empire would bring in Trajan as their emperor. Trajan was born in Spain. He wasn't Roman. He wasn't Italian. That Rome was a multicultural empire. And in many ways, Coca-Cola, McDonald's are multicultural and multinational in that sense.
Well, our guest, John Pfeffer, independent journalist, author of the book North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy and the Korean Peninsula, published 2003, and sometime soon a book dealing with these very issues we've been talking about this morning. He'll be giving a talk. The topic is The Global Food Court, Fast Food, Slow Food, Imperial Food, this afternoon, 4 o'clock on the U of I campus at the Levis Faculty Center. This is co-sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study, part of their Globalization Initiative, and also some support from the ACES Global Connect series and also the Korea Workshop. Thanks very much for being
here. Thank you.